Season 5 of the Telly Award-winning podcast, coming at you like I, Ramel Young, and Kelvin Cortazar Brodus, better known as Dr. Dre and Snoop D-O-double-D, 1, 2, and whoa, running freaking Grand Navalone at the dough, ready to make an entrance, so back on up. As you know, we're about to rip shit up. Island Grant, screenwriter, Ringo Award-winning grader of fine comics like Everin, Banjax, The Jump, and The Breach, which you can grab with a late pledge on Kickstarter. The other voice in the dark, the man in the box to the left is...
David Avalone, writer of things and stuff and junk, currently drawing blood from Image over my shoulder, and nice. Writing on Batwheels for Warner Brothers Animation. And coming next year from Dynamite, Two-Fisted Fairy Tales, which I'm very excited to be finally getting out there.
Nothing wrong with that. If you missed any of our previous conversations, episodes featuring comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Rodney Barnes, and many more, our entire catalog can be sold via YouTube, Apple Pods, and other purveyors of worthwhile ear cracks. So double on back and check it all out. Apologize right off the bat. I am sick. I am slow. I am hobbled, but I'm powering through, man. I do it for the art. Doing this for you guys. I should be in bed. I'm recording the damn podcast, and it's going to be fun. We got a great guest. Do you have anything else you want to pimp? You kind of dropped a little bit on us already. Is there stuff coming out?
Yeah, those are really the only things. Drawing Blood, Volume 1 of the trade paperback is out there. I am led to believe it is not just in comic book stores, but it is also in reputable booksellers, which is nice. And it collects the first 4 issues of Drawing Blood and the Radically Rearranged Ronin Ragdoll's #1 issue and stuff like that there. Batwheels is on Max and on Netflix. So far of the 5 episodes I've written, 1 has aired. If that's what we're not really still calling that air. No air was involved.
It has been uploaded to the Matrix. It is being streamed.
There is an encode of it on 2 platforms, to use the speak of the 21st century. And it's good, clean, wholesome American fun, writing Batman for kids, Batman Where Nobody Can Get Punched. Is a novel enterprise, but an enjoyable one. And that's what I've been up to this year. How about you?
It used to just be that he couldn't use a gun, and now he can't even punch people. Yeah. This is where society's headed, man. Yeah. My films, State of Consciousness, starring Emile Hirsch, and Haunted Heart, starring Matt Dillon from Academy Award-winning director Fernando Treva, have also been uploaded to The Matrix. You can find those on VOD and streamers. It's there. Go see it. My books, you know, Aberrant Banjax, Suicide Jockeys can be found in fine comic shops everywhere. The Breach, like I said, is still available on Kickstarter if you want to go toss a late pledge at it. I filed a shit ton of paperwork last week, LLC paperwork for Half Evil Comics. And I am, you know, with the film business kind of flailing, you know, dead for a little bit. I am greatly expanding the publishing business. So look forward to some new announcements, some new endeavors from Half Evil Comics. Cool. We are officially an LLC in the eyes of the state of California. So moving forward, but let's speaking of moving forward, let's get our guests on. They're much more interesting than we are.
Meet Lily and Generoso.
Hello. Howdy, howdy.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us on.
Our pleasure, of course. Tell the kids at home a little bit about yourselves.
So I'm Lily, and I'm one half of the comics team.
I'm Generoso. We are the Plastic Grapes.
We make experimental dystopian comics, and a lot of them are always interested in experiential elements of science and also being subjects of science as well.
And Lily, you, if I remember correctly, part of your origin story is that you're a scientist?
Yeah, I was originally a computational cognitive scientist for a while, and then moved on and did some research around like informatics and in the space of genetics and education, healthcare. Yeah, and these days I work just like more on the data side of things. But yeah, science will always have a very, very near and dear place to my heart.
Nice. Yeah, when I was in college, I took a science history class that was a required class. And my college didn't do minors, but I really liked the professor. I ended up taking a half dozen science classes, mostly from an epistemology standpoint, the history of, you know, history of the development of ideas, basically. But I have to say that has informed my work as a writer as much as any lit class I ever took. It's, you know, it informed the way I looked at the world and the way I look at stories and the stories humanity keeps telling itself over and over again. And it's I always try to encourage people who want to work in the arts, learn something else, figure out be interested in other things, because it'll always find its way into your work.
Yeah.
Writers that only write about writing, filmmakers that make films about like, a few decent ones, but man does it get tired and man does it get worn. Yeah. Live, learn.
Yeah. You can tell my father wrote Private Eye novels and was a World War II veteran. And when there was another wave of Private Eye writers in the 80s, he read a few of them and he said, none of these people have thrown a punch in their life ever. And he's like, and they're writing about it, but you can tell they've never fired a firearm. They've never run away from anyone shooting at them. They've never and they haven't done anything to learn what that would feel like.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that's it's not a particularly revolutionary thing to say artists should be, and writers particularly should be, well-rounded, but it's a listening job.
And that's part of my introduction to comics was that way. And it's funny you should say, because my father was also in World War II. And as a young person, he never liked to talk about it. So I started reading G.I. Combat and Sergeant Fury. And every now and then I'd be like, hey, Pa, look at this. Was it like this? And it's like, sometimes, you know, really. Sure.
But I've always thought it's because of the overall vibe of both companies. You know, DC is sort of the conservative company, and particularly in the 70s, and Marvel is kind of the more let it all hang out hippie thing. And it's always kind of amused me that DC Comics, when they did war comics, they were grim and sad and anti-war, and Marvel did Nick Fury, which is World War II as a superhero experience, where, you know, with a lot of fantastic things and everything's a lot of laughs, and there, you know, there's a little reality of war in there. But I think it's funny that, you know, Kirby and Lee wanted the Fantastic Four, but World War II, which is very much not what DC was doing in GI Combat and Star Spangled War Stories and Our Army at War and all of those. It's another complete tangent about publishing, but it's interesting to me how many things start with the idea that they're going to be anthologies, and then they do one character that takes off and they're like, because all of the DC war comics up until the late 70s they all have anthology titles. The Unknown Soldier is Star Spangled War Stories. Sergeant Rock is Our Army at War.
The Hornet Tank is GI Combat.
GI Combat. And I think that's all because, like, they were supposed to be anthology books and then went, no, let's do 150 stories about Sergeant Rock instead. And it's an interesting, you know, The Shadow, going back to the pulps, The Shadow magazine was a detective anthology. And when they did the radio show, it came from the radio show, and people bought it as an anthology. And they're like, no, we want a pulp magazine about the narrator of the show. You know, it's basically like if they were buying Tales from the Crypt and they went, no, we just want stories about the Crypt Keeper. Actually, throw out all this other stuff. Just give me Crypt Keeper stories. And that's what The Shadow comes to be. It's like, I love Twilight Zone. Can I only have stories about Rod Serling actually. Like, that's what they want. And it's a fascinating, people like characters. People like to follow the same, you know, television is built on, I want these people in my living room every day, every week. But let's go back to the start. Where do you come into doing comics together? And who has the bright idea, or is it a mutual thing?
I think doing comics together was pretty mutual, but it was a longstanding process of there was quite a bit of collaboration and other things that built up to comics. Mm-hmm. So, before we started doing comics together, we did a radio show. That's how we met. And so we did a radio show first. Then we also were writing film critique together.
We still do.
And we still do to this day. We decided that, we were reading comics. I read a lot immediately after I graduated college, because up until that point, I'd been super focused on becoming a scientist. And I finished MIT, and I was really lucky to be really close to an excellent comic shop in our neighborhood. And at that point, I finally, I graduated and I could let my hair down a little and breathe and started going to the comic shop and started to kind of really enjoy what was coming in on the consignment shelves, as well as also the independent shelves. So things from Drawn and Quarterly, Spark Plug, from Fantagraphics. Sure. And it just was building up my interest in it. And then I think Generoso's always had an interest in comics for a long time, since childhood. And at some point we thought to ourselves, we've worked on a lot of different things together, and we wanted to do something that was really purely original and entirely from us, and comics just felt like this perfect match of the things we've done, and then also my own interest in writing, and then Generoso's own background in art.
We should say before we get too far, the reason we know each other is you guys were covering LA Comic Con for a website. At that point you were journalisting. And you were in one of my believe it was a publishing your first comic panel, and you had written, you wrote something. It was very complimentary, but it was very thoughtful. It was very nice, and we had a big long conversation afterwards. I'm so fascinated by these stories, because it was you were very clearly you had stories in your head, you had ideas in your head, you had notions in your head back then. And I was the same guy. I was, I had written in Hollywood for 12 years before I ever did a comic. And I was sitting in panels and I'm trying to get the right information, and every once in a while I'd trip over something that was useful and he'd hold on to it. And the reason I started doing those panels, because at some point, I had heard a lot of good information. I'd heard a lot of bad information. I had sorted through it all. At some point, I thought I had, most of the information. I thought I had the information one would need to launch one of these things. And I thought it was kind of, it was a bad idea to just hold on to it, that I needed to share it with people. And so it is very interesting to me every time I meet somebody because I was the guy in the panel who is now doing panels. And you were the people in the audience at the panel, and now I'm sitting here holding your book. this is your fourth book, in fact. That is a miracle to me. That's amazing. That's awesome. That's incredible. So Generoso, go ahead. I interrupted you, but I thought it was important to set the stage, because this is cool. You know what I'm saying? You guys are watching me on stage, and now you're on the show as creators. That's incredible.
It's a beautiful circle, if you really think about it. Because at the time that we met, we're running Frank 19, and covering what was happening there. And at that time, we were beginning what we call our thesis book.
Yes.
And we ended up making almost a 200-page graphic novel that will never see the light of day. but it really was. We tried everything out, and we were playing with ideas with Autobio and mixing that with a lot of the experimental stuff that you've come to know in the four books that we've made, since officially going to Domino. And there was a lot of experimentation there. And we're really proud of the thesis book, but it's ours. And it was like our school for learning. I was in Philadelphia. I actually learned how to be an artist at the High School for Creative and Performing Arts, which was a public high school. Learned from the great Phil Sumter, who's still my mentor and still very much with us at 92, I believe, and taught me a lot about what I do now. But you know, something like your panel is a great example. We were in Los Angeles. We began working on what we were working on. And we didn't know how to proceed in a lot of ways. So you were really sweet that after the panel, you spoke with us for an extended period of time. And we took a lot of that information. And some of it we've used, some of it we took in our own direction, but it's all been extremely helpful. But yeah, and that's what led us to putting out our first book in 2022.
I want to roll back a little bit just to find out, Generoso, what was your childhood relationship with comic books aside from reading The Haunted Tank and Sergeant Fury?
That is the absolute beginning, is what we would say. That's the absolute beginning. So it's you know, I would hang out with my father. He would pick up the Italian newspaper. They had comic books on the stand. I immediately gravitated towards all the war comics for that reason that I just said, that just trying to get a better sense of what my dad had done. Mm. And then read those for years. And I was about 13 years old when, like most people that got into that comic, I saw Harvey Pekar on David Letterman. And he was played off for laughs, but I was like, well, I don't know. I think I want to read these comics. These sound like something that makes sense to me. And I did. I was able to get them in Philadelphia, a really great shop in downtown. And that fueled my interest in comics being something other than what was coming out on the major comics labels. So started reading American Splendor and then started reading the more strange stuff, obviously Love and Rockets, things like that. But really it was Splendor that was a catalyst to make me think about it. But I had been an illustrator since I was a child. I'm a fine painter, oil painter when I'm not doing comic book stuff. And there's a little bit of that. And then Lily is the writer.
Yeah. And for me, I think science is always like a big element, but then I also was really into literary criticism when I was young. And so that kind of still sits with me to this day. Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why when you look at our books, there are a ton of different influences that we're trying to bring together. There are visual influences, there are narrative influences, there are philosophical influences. It's just this kind of blending of really like our two perspectives together.
Sure. Well, and that's the trick, isn't it? It's, you know, you take your, I think every artist starts with just imitating what they see, just remaking what they see and love. And if you are going to go anywhere, it all becomes synthesized into something that's uniquely yours. And you can see there's a bit of that, there's a bit of that, there's a bit of that. But the sum is very different from the parts, you know, that it's not simply, you know, I say it's the difference between the Venture Brothers and Family Guy. That idea of like, here's a reference to a thing you will recognize. There's no joke connected to it in any way, shape, or form. No. It's just a thing. Whereas on the Venture Brothers, you get, here's a character who is clearly based on Sean Connery's James Bond, but he's also William S. Burroughs for some reason.
Yep.
And he's also Alan Quatermain, which connects to Burroughs and being an English, you know, a Westerner living in North Africa. But it also connects to James Bond because Sean Connery played Alan Quatermain. Like that complexity of reference, where it's just a thing on top of a thing on top of another thing, and it creates something that is wholly new, you know, even though it has been squeezed from 20 different oranges, it ain't orange juice. It's, you know, it's something else new. And that's, everybody's been doing that since the beginning of time. You know, that's, I wrote Zorro a few years ago, and I was fascinated by like trying to go back and find the first version. Because after Zorro, you have the Shadow, and then you have Batman. Before Zorro, you have the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Sure.
but you also have Robin Hood, I think. You know what I mean? Like the guy who's an aristocrat, but he fights against aristocrats and he wears a costume and he jumps out from behind the bushes. Like there's a, he's still Batman a little bit. You know, there's still like, there's still a Batman and Robin Hood share a DNA because humanity will not stop telling itself the same stories over and over and over. You know, even, you know, even the mythological idea of Moses having been an Egyptian prince always reminded me of Robin Hood. It's like, why does the guy fighting for the common man, he's never the common man. He's always, well, Shakespeare. Like, we can't believe a common man rose up and did this. It's got to be, oh no, but really he's royalty. It's like, do we have to do that every time? You know, like, give me the Jedi that's not related to anybody. That's what I was like. But yeah.
It is what I love about these books, about your books, is that, I mean, I think that they do not smack of other stuff out there. And again, I mean it in a very complimentary way. I've been obsessed recently, and I had the episode hasn't aired yet, but I had Sean Lewis on for like a fireside chat. And we ended up talking about a lot of things, but Sean, like me, is obsessed recently with the idea of what a comic can be and maybe what it should be. There's a lot of recycling that goes on, you know. And I mean, I said this in the last episode, if I see another like Snow White with boobs or Alice in Wonderland with boobs, or Little Red Riding Hood is a samurai, or you know what I'm saying, it's there's stuff that whatever sells on Kickstarter or catches an eye, you know, in a comic shop, but it's like, but to me it's, you know, it's recycled, it's old, it's tired. And here's the thing, you should do one of those if you do it in a way that we haven't seen before. I think you're already fighting off your back if you are recycling to that extent already. These read like poems, you know. It is that's what they feel like to me. It is a bit of, I don't know, it is you know, it is prose poetry. There are words in there, but it is a visual poem. But it is like from an idea standpoint, it is poetry, and that is interesting to me. And I have never committed to it to this extent. You know, I try to bring in some of these elements into, you know, a more traditional you know, narrative story or whatever. It's kind of what I strive for. It's what I aim for. When Sean Lewis and I were talking about it, I talked about Steven Soderbergh, where, yeah, you know, it is a guy who can make the perfect, you know, he can make Aaron Brockovich, which is the ideal A to B to C straightforward Hollywood story. But he was this guy who constantly did one for them and then one for him, one for them, right, one for him. And he didn't really find his stride until he combined those two things, right? It's like, you know, he would do a very straightforward Hollywood story, but then he would make something like Schizopolis, which was just a thought experiment on film, right? And then it was, and then he somehow talks someone into giving him the out of sight job, right? And Elmore Leonard is you know, probably my favorite storyteller ever, and Out of Sight is one of his favorite books. And Rick had a great eye for collaborators, and he had George Clooney before George Clooney was really George Clooney, and he had Jennifer Lopez before Jennifer Lopez was really Jennifer Lopez, and throw in Michael Keaton and Dennis Farina and all of these amazing people. But you watch it, you know, it is a traditional Hollywood film, but man, does he tell that story in a way that we're not used to, in a way that is really interesting and really challenging, and he brought the poetry into this thing that it could have been very plain, it could have been vanilla ice cream, but man, does he dress it up and make it interesting and challenging. Yeah, so I'm, you know, I'm in this state where I'm like, I am aiming for Out of Sight. And when I read something like this, it's so instructive, it's so interesting. And, you know, and again, like it expands my mind. It makes me think about what a comic can be, and I think to a degree what it should be. And so that's interesting. I'm interested to hear, like, you know, how you, because you get, I mean, you're going to spend a lot of time. You're going to put in a lot of effort. Generoso, you draw all of this stuff, and the art is beautiful. And the art is different. It's so you. So what makes you go in this direction? Because again, like we can infinite possibility, but we're headed in this direction, and you end up with something amazing. But how do you end up?
Oh, I think we cut off your last word there, Ryland.
Yeah. I was just saying, how do you end up there? Yeah. I think my internet is shorting. Yeah.
That's okay. No. Thank you for the question.
Yes, and thank you for all of the observations and the compliments. We're very touched and honored that you enjoy our work, because we know that our work can be perceived as sometimes a little bit challenging, but it's not meant to be. It's really meant, just like poetry, to give you an experience and to put you in a place where you can feel through what these characters are seeing and responding to, whether that is what is in reality or inside of their minds or somewhere in a dream state or, you know, some ambiguous plane of consciousness that we don't always articulate. And so I think that's the reason why we got there is, that thesis book was a little bit more straightforward and a little bit more conventional in its storytelling, but it had these moments of the ethereal and more of this kind of first person element that was thrown in within the main conventional narrative. And we realized we really like those parts the most. And so I think that was like the thing that you learn by doing what you really, you find those things that you really enjoy. And so we realized this is a kind of way of storytelling that we're a little bit more interested in. Besides that, when we get started on any book, we always start with a pure prose treatment. Mm-hmm. And that prose treatment by design is supposed to have a certain degree of ambiguity in poetry so that it can plant the seeds of the concept, evoke some images, but then also give us a little bit of a playground to where, as we start to talk about the visuals, it can grow and adapt, and we can have these two forces kind of play against each other a bit. So like that narrative prose versus the image, and have them iterate around each other and maybe change and evolve, mm-hmm. and then change the course of what the final kind of experience of the book is going to be.
I think that's it. And we actually have something. I don't know if we can share screen, but last month we had our book release at a great bookstore in Cleveland called Max Bax. And we've been asked a lot of times whenever people are like, well, you guys are husband and wife. How does that work? You know, like, how are you able to not kill each other? How are you able to work? What are the concessions? Are the concessions hard? And so we actually came up with this diagram. Is it possible to share this? I don't know.
We don't really do, because a lot of it is an audio, like 90% of our audience is not able to see.
90% of our audience is, yeah.
That's totally fine. It's basically what Lily describes, though. It's research. It's the prose treatment. You know, how does that essentially evolve into what we get as a final book? And we realized this was done through that thesis book, a lot of trial and error, a lot of bad nights where it's like, what do you want from me? And no, because, you know, I'm operating off of her initial guidelines, and I'm going to come up with visuals that I think address these guidelines. Sometimes I'm not right. And what's in her head and what I'm hoping for. And you know, it's easy to say that I'm just doing the art and she's doing the writing, but she takes on some of the art. She's the letterer. She's the person that does a lot of the editing, you know, at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. We like to describe it as like when the process starts, I'm the screenwriter and Generoso is the cinematographer. And then when it comes time to actually putting the book together, we're actually co-directors. And mm-hmm. that is how a lot of the book gets made. And that process in turn leads to these much more kind of experiential type books all together. Sure. Because I think with that thesis book, what we, in a more conventional like narrative storytelling form, it didn't allow us to kind of cross each other's boundaries as much. And it was giving, I think, a certain kind of rigidity that we both were not exactly vibing. And so then we had to kind of step back and think about really what we wanted to make, what we wanted people to feel, what topics were we interested in exploring. And after some trial by error and revisions to our total process, we got to where we're at.
So when you start with the prose treatment, how much of a script do you write? Or is it Generoso deciding how many pages a moment or panels a moment shall take? Or do you say this all happens on this page and this all happens on this page and this all happens on this page?
Great question. Yeah. So what happens is with the prose treatment, I do a first cut of approximately this is what is going to be in one page and then another. And I basically mark up and destroy my one prose treatment. Immediately after I do that markup, Generoso and I come together and we actually do kind of, we call them almost like page specifications because they're bigger than thumbnails. They're not really thumbnails. They're typically like either an 8.5 by 11 page or they are a page in like a sketchbook. And we actually talk through that breakdown and we do quite a bit of revision there. Sometimes we will contract scenes. Sometimes we'll make them a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'll reintroduce things for a little bit of a better pacing, change some order, add a new idea. But yeah, that's typically how that prose treatment ultimately gets broken down.
And you're mostly, if not entirely, working towards an original graphic novel. You're not doing monthly floppies on anything. You're not doing 6 20 page chapters or anything like that ever.
No, but the size of our books is you know, differentiated from the first triptych we did of Vessel, Inversion, and Shua. They range from 56 pages to Inversion, the middle book, which is 92 pages. So we keep them fairly tight in that way. Ryan Carey from Four Color Apocalypse Comics Journal, he always calls them mini graphic novels. I'm like, okay, that sounds right.
Graphic novellas. Yep.
Yeah. We're okay with that. So that, you know, the lengths are really tight in that way. But yeah, and our first two books came out within the same year because the first one we had been working on for over a year and a half. Yeah. And then the one that followed up was a combination of that time period. And it came out very late the same year. So people were like, wow, two books in 1 year. What are you guys doing? It's like, well, we're working 50-hour week jobs and doing this till 4 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. And it's pretty intense, but that pacing is tough. And yeah, the one that Rylan just held up, Absolute Simultaneity, which came out this summer, is that's 4 and 2.5 years. So it's a lot. Thank you, Rylan.
And these are, you have a publisher for these? That's that is not you. There's no.
Nope. We are self-published. We do all soup to nuts. It's us. We have a main distributor in terms of like we sell our books in the Domino Books shop, the online shop in Austin English has really treated us incredibly well, and Domino Books is a great distributor. And then there are multiple bookstores across the country that have been carrying our books, and we've been incredibly grateful for them because they actually supported us from the very beginning. So as we were coming up as like, you know, no provenance, no example of work, we just showed them like what we'd recently made in a review, and they've been supporting us ever since.
And Domino gets you in bookstores across the country?
No, Domino is actually just an online retailer. He does do wholesale, so that there could be like some.
And there has been.
Access to bookstores, but its primary method of distribution is that main online shop.
Okay.
And so why would you? Oh, please.
I was going to say, so you guys have done the hard work to get it into bookstores.
trying our best. I mean, we give a lot of credit to what Austin. So Austin English, who's the owner of Domino Books, is a phenomenal artist and comics creator. Meskin and Mesko is one of our favorite books of the last 5 years. Very experimental. He curates that shop meticulously. And what goes online is absolutely where he feels that kind of comic belongs. So it was a huge honor when he's like, oh my God, I love to carry a book. And we were very taken with that. And because of that, he carries books from all over the world. They're in that art comics, experimental comics vein. So, and he only exists as an online entity, but he sells the shops all over the place. And so because of that, on top of our pursuit of these individual independent comic shops, it gets into other shops as well. And so that's how our work has been seen by people outside of our physically handing it to them at a Comic-Con.
Right. No, that's backbreaking work. That's, you know, that's the distribution is the hardest nut to crack, and there are people who will call, you know, 500 bookstores and five of them will order the book, and you know, you do your best. It's you know, and even if you do have, I was in a Barnes and Noble in Glendale this weekend and discovered they had one copy of my latest OGN from Image. And luckily I talked someone in the store into buying it. She was like, okay, I'll order a couple more copies. There we go.
That's a win.
And we're off, you know. We'll get it done.
Is that what you do on the weekends, Evelyn?
Yeah, I go to bookstores.
I can sign it for you right
here. Yeah. No, it was actually a colleague who was doing a signing there. And the book that I have out now, I co-created with Kevin Eastman. And this guy wrote on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle cartoon series. So I was like, oh, if you're interested in Kevin Eastman. I have a book I made with him, but yeah, it's what are you working on right now? What's the next one?
Yeah, so it's in its early research phase. Mm-hmm. Won't say much about it. I think that the biggest thing for us is that we'd like to do something that is pretty much entirely made by ourselves, and that the books that we've done so far, we still work with a printer. This time around, we want to do something a little bit different and maybe move a little bit backwards in time and do something that is more handmade and create something that is a purer. I'm not going to say it's a pure art object, but a purer art object.
Yeah, we've been working. In this city, there's a great collective, a printer collective called Zygote, and we're members of it and learning all these new printing techniques. We currently are learning letterpress, but there's other forms that we're actually getting into right now. And so we're going to adapt a lot of these different techniques and into this new thing that we're making. We love the folks that have been printing our books. We get them printed in the States. We think they do a great job. I love the colors and I love how they're put together. But yeah, we definitely are going to try to do something soup to nuts, including making a physical book, which is scary.
Yeah, that's you know, that takes me back to the old developing your own film world, which is, you know, I grew up in a very tactile world of filmmaking, where there was, you know, digital nothing, and everything was by hand on equipment that seemed extremely Victorian at the time. I love when I go back to my old school, literally the machines I made my senior project on are in the library, are in the lobby as like museum
artifacts.
This is how grandpa cut film. It's like, yes, that is how grandpa. But I think that's great, you know, seizing the means of production and whatnot.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is this step. There's art in printing, right? And we kind of, to a degree, take it out of the equation. It's like, okay, well, the book is done. The artistic process is done. Let me just send some digital files over for somebody to spit out. And we don't think about that, you know. I mean, I go back to Steven Soderbergh, where it's like, okay, well, I want, you know, I have Detroit, I have Florida, I have these other locations, and I want to look different, you know. So let me start thinking about how we're processing the film. I'm gonna cross process this film. right? It's going to give everything this kind of bluish hue, right? I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And so it's like, well, and with him, I mean, he shot all his films, he edited all his films. And so he was, you can get into why that's not a good idea for everyone. It seems to have worked out okay for him, but it was like the art did not stop. It was like, okay, well, he went and sought out ways that he could continue to kind of push the envelope and to kind of infuse art and into the process. And I think that's interesting, you know. And yeah, go ahead.
Oh no, but I love Soderbergh for that. And I always draw the equation between what Soderbergh has done with film and what Sonic Youth started doing later in their career in the 90s and the 2000s. You know, I used to look forward, and if you're fans at all, you know, they would put out their record once every year and a half on Warner Brothers. And it's, you know, the record that's supposed to get some radio airplay. And then separately, they would put out these little red and green CDs where they would work with artists that Akira Mori or Hazel Ackett, or these people that not necessarily are going to be burning up the top 40 dial, but they wanted to do these experiments. You got to believe it all filters back. I think another example of that is Jonathan Glazer, right? When Jonathan Glazer isn't making films like Sexy Beast, you know, he's making commercials, like actual commercials. And we got a chance to chat with them about when he came out with the film with Scarlett Johansson, Under the Skin,
yeah.
About how much that he uses all these techniques that he develops, making commercial work, putting them into the more experimental elements of his mainstream films. So what you're trying to do, and you know, in your admiration for Soderbergh, is that blending of what he's doing with the girlfriend experience. How is he bringing that into Ocean's 11? How is this work staying somewhere in between? That balance, I wanted to address it because I think it's very, very hard to keep that mindset of, you know, these are my experiments. This is the thing I do that's more mainstream, quote unquote. And can I bring some of that experience experimentally into the mainstream work and get away with it? Because I don't think Schizopolis made that much money, but it's a great film. I love it. Yeah, but the next movie he made was Out of Sight. And, you know, and that brought that whole other aspect of his career out.
Yeah. My favorite film of his, I think, is probably The Limey, which has a plot that's been done about 500 times.
Sure.
And it's, you know, ostensibly about gangster finds out his daughter has committed suicide, or maybe she did, or maybe she died in a car accident, and he's trying to find out who's responsible. But the way it's shot and edited, it becomes a movie about how memory functions.
Absolutely.
Exactly. The movie is not a revenge fantasy. It's about memory. And particularly he and Peter Fonda are two guys who are remembering the 60s in very different ways. And it's also about how most people's memories of the 60s are bullshit. You know, I love when Peter Fonda says, yeah, when people talk about the 60s, we're talking about like 2 or 3 months in 1967 in San Francisco. It's like, it really, like the rest of the world, that wasn't happening. Like, people weren't wearing tie dye everywhere. Like, it's just, but it's about these, you know, myths that we build about ourselves. And I think that, you know, I think it's a pretty natural arc when you grow up wanting to make things, that the first impulse is always narrative. The first impulse is always, I want to tell stories like the stories I've seen. And, you know, for you guys, it was Harvey Pekar, you know, for a lot of filmmakers, I can't tell you the number of people. It's funny when you find out what a cliche your origin story is. But like, you know, I wanted to grow up and make movies like Howard Hawks and Michael Curtiz, you know, classic American Hollywood, well-constructed entertainments. And then, you know, like every other middle-aged white filmmaker, I saw Fellini's 8 and a Half and went, you can actually make movies about, I think actually the first one I saw was La Dolce Vita, and someone asked me after I saw it, what'd you think of it? And I said, it's like someone made Apocalypse Now about nightclubbing.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like, you know, applying this epic, poetic, visionary thing to people hanging around in tuxedos and drinking martinis. like that you can make something that big and human and epic and terrifying and beautiful, but it's not about war and it's not about disease. It's about just life. And I think for so many people, Love and Rockets is very influenced by Fellini, I think. Particularly Gilbert's work is very, very, very influenced by Fellini. And I think that thing of like, oh, I don't, every story doesn't have to end with the bad guy getting killed by the good guy. That is not the only, that is not the only outcome. And in fact, in the real world, as we learn to our horror, that's rarely the outcome. How do we help our fellow human beings deal with these other outcomes? How do we help them understand their own lives? I mean, that's, you know, that's so much of what people get out of art is an idea of, you know, what is life and what are lives, and there's no higher calling in a way than that thing where you're trying to reflect life back to people and help them understand things. You know, I like to say I had a problem in my life about 10 years ago, and I went to therapy for it, and therapy was great and very, very helpful. But I found a 3-day run of Peanuts cartoons that absolutely boiled the issue down and saved my soul. And I went, that's what the problem is. That's what the problem is, that Lucy is embarrassed by Linus. That's the thing that my therapist didn't boil down quite as well as those three, talking about 9 panels drawn by Charles Schulz. 3-day run in a newspaper strip in the 70s or 60s. And I stumbled across them online and went, holy shit. And there's one episode of Better Call Saul that also was the same, like, oh, that's what I'm going through. Okay. Now I see it. Now I see it. And that's, everybody wants that from art.
Yeah.
Everybody wants that experience. Everybody wants to be seen, you know? So.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that right now in particular, we live in very ambiguous times. And all of our books are always operating in that space of ambiguousness. And it's done intentionally because of the fact that, like, when you have so much stimuli hitting you all the time and you still don't exactly know where to go, that's a feeling that all of us have every like 3 minutes of the day, right? And I think like for that reason, all of our characters are trying to understand something about themselves and the world around them, and they don't really know exactly either, but they're taking everything step by step as best as they can and just reacting to the now and trying to see how the now is playing a little bit back towards their history, towards maybe their own projections. And that's what we have to do on a day-to-day basis in order to try to navigate through like how confusing things are right now. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big, big part of what we're focused on and what we hope our brings to people is that feeling of, hey, it's okay to be confused, because right. We all are pretty confused all the time. And all of our, all of the books have a scientist of some kind at its center. And I think like one of the most important parts of science is always saying, I just don't know.
Right. Yeah. Applying the scientific method to life, where very few things are a repeatable experiment, gets repeatable results in human life. And that's, you know, the irony is that some of the best avant-garde work reflects how humans actually experience reality more straightforward narrative does. Nobody alive experiences life in a straightforward narrative way. No one does. We don't. Things happen out of order, you know. Things, you know, writing any kind of memoir, any kind of autobiography, you actually have to wait until you've figured out what the story was about, and that is very rarely 5 minutes after the event concluded. You know what I mean? You have to take a long time and go, oh, that was the moral of that story. That was the thing that was trying to teach me. You know,
very rare too, right? And our memories are unreliable as
absolutely.
Well. And you have to, and I think you have to always exactly like ask yourself, like, this is what I am learning from that experience right at this moment in my life. Mm-hmm. I might learn something totally different tomorrow.
No, and human beings are pattern making monkeys. That's like, that's the main thing we do, is we see patterns that aren't there. And sometimes we can make them be there because of our belief in them. Mm-hmm. But that desire, I always say you can't, there's no such thing as an avant-garde film. If you take 10 random images and put them together and show them to an audience of human beings, those people in the audience, half of them will figure out what those images, what you were trying to say with those 10 images in a row. And they will be wrong because you were not trying. But for them, they're right. Like, you can't show people 10 completely disconnected images and have them go, those are 10 images that have nothing to do with one another. Their minds will reject that. And they will go, no, the lighthouse was this thing. And then the train was this other thing. And then the waves breaking on the shore. Obviously, this is a love story. It's like, what? The lighthouse and the train and the waves? Yeah, sure. It's a love story. I get it now. But you literally cannot stop people doing it. And that's what we fall asleep at night, and the machine goes on that turns all of the imagery into narrative, you know, and we wake up in the morning and go, why was I thinking about a lighthouse? I have no idea. You know?
And I think it's part of that. I think it's also the Cullenshaw effect, right? If you think about it, this, again, this idea, little girl playing, dead body, somebody eating ice cream, dead body.
Yeah.
Just very, very simple. And then all of a sudden, like, you're going to start seeing these fairly happy events in a different way, then intersplice that dead body with other things. It takes on a completely other meaning. So you can really play with that. And I agree with what you say about the avant-garde. And there is always something to be pulled from it. That was another thing that really influenced this, is that back in Boston, where we lived for a lot of years, there was a professor at the Massachusetts College of Art named Saul Levine, still very much with us, a great experimental filmmaker. And every Wednesday, for a whopping $3, he would actually screen avant film on 16mm Super 8, 35, whatever he had his hands on. And that really was an education. We had seen elements of experimental cinema within, you know, the context of more mainstream kind of stuff, but really getting into experimental cinema with Saul and how that changed our perspective on comic books. A little bit of the Cullenshaw effect with life, right?
Oh, sure.
You have that element of seeing really avant film. All of a sudden, you start looking at standard order biocomics and you're like, well, these are great. And I want to make sure we get this. There's a ton of great mainstream comic stuff out there. We love it. We love it around this. We love what you do. It's all great, but sometimes it goes in a different direction, which Saul shows. He's still the guy that will show up at the Harvard Film Archive and watch the Michael Curtis film and have, you know, ear-to-ear smile on his face, or a Robert Aldrich film. And doesn't mean it always has to be the avant. Yeah.
No, and, I, the thing is, there's a degree of artistry where I think people can watch Michael Curtiz and Howard Hawks and not see the avant-garde and not see the manipulation of time and space that's happening in an artful way, because it is so well done as to be invisible, as opposed to the, you know, a Dadaist film aggressively trying to get you to disassociate from images. And that's the whole, you know, that, the job of making people feel things and putting them in that sort of poetic trance, you know, and you can do it in a short story and you can do it in a comic book and you can do it in a movie. And all of the tools are there for you, including the avant-garde ones. And as Soderbergh proves, there is nothing keeping you from using the avant-garde tools in your gangster revenge story and turning it into something utterly unlike. And I think an audience that went to the Limey to see Terrence Stamp get brutal violence or violent revenge on Peter Fonda would have been perfectly satisfied with that movie.
Sure. Like,
they don't, you know, they don't have to care or notice that it's about how memory functions. But that's to me, that's the neatest trick, is when you can hit them with the art and they think they've been entertained, you know, And they're like, no, that was just entertainment. It's like, good. I'm glad that's what you got out of it. You know,
it is funny. There's a decent commentary on the Limey DVD with it's Herbert Lem Dobbs. And yeah. Lem Dobbs is he's written a lot of decent things, but Lem Dobbs, man, was he not on board with what Spielberg did to his script? You know, Lem Dobbs wrote what he thought was, you know, this revolutionary revenge tale. And, you know, you listen to the commentary and he's sitting in a room with Soderbergh saying it. And it's like, he thinks that Soderbergh just completely destroyed his beautiful script. And it's just funny because he's just sitting in there and he's just so stuck in his ways. And he's so, and he does not realize that like the only reason that this film is watchable, memorable, and, you know, and it is in many circles, it is a classic, you know, it is because Soderbergh, you know, he did something different with it. You know, he thought about what a film could be and maybe what it should be. You know, and right down to it being like an unofficial sequel, the Ken Loach film Poor Cow, you know.
Right.
Which was so revolutionary and a nod. It was like Soderbergh is the biggest Ken Loach fan who has ever lived, and talk about a guy who did it differently. Ken Loach was another guy who's like, okay, let's look at what a film can be, and let's look at how a film can reflect reality. And that was so interesting, and it was you know, it is this cycle. I mean, and I think it's a responsibility we have when we're putting stuff into the world, is that well, there's no Steven Soderbergh without Ken Loach. Ken Loach watched Steven Soderbergh watched Ken Loach and said and said, oh wow, like look what can happen. And you know, then there was me and Soderbergh is a big influence but I was I'd watched years and years of just regular film. And regular film is amazing. I don't want to be a snob or anything, but then I walked into a theater and I saw Pulp Fiction and I was like, oh my God, like we can do this. Holy shit. I take that as a responsibility. It's like, when I got into comics specifically, and part of it was, so I moved out here. I went to the American Film Institute Conservatory, I was going to make Pulp Fiction, but by the time I got in the workforce, Hollywood wasn't making those movies anymore. It was almost impossible to get them made. And I ended up kind of pigeonholed as a, you know, an action movie writer. And, again, I don't want to be the guy who complains about getting to do that, because it's awesome. And I love those movies as much as I love anything else, but it was like, but there was this hole, you know, where I wasn't getting to tell the stories I'd come to Hollywood to tell. And in comics, I very much found an opportunity. And so when I got into comics, I made the promise to myself that I was never going to tell a straightforward A to B to story. I was never going to give anybody vanilla ice cream. And even if I was telling a story that was familiar, I was telling it in a very challenging way. And perhaps in the beginning, I was telling a familiar story so I could fully commit to telling it in a challenging way. You know, I think about Banjax and, Banjax is a Batman and Robin story, you know, at its heart. But told in a completely bonkers way. I mean, the odd issues are told from Batman's point of view. The even issues are told from Robin's point of view, and they're telling the same story, but they're describing the same events, but they're telling a very different story. And don't know who's telling the truth, and maybe nobody's telling the truth. You're left in the end to sort through it. What actually happened here? That's interesting. Issue three is told from the perspective of someone who hasn't slept in 7 days, and it is literally driving him mad. And so again, like if you just describe, well, this happens, it may sound like, oh, well, have we seen before? Well, you haven't seen it before through the eyes of somebody who hasn't slept in 7 days and is being driven mad. And so you literally have no idea, like, is this actually happening? Like how much of this is actually happening? And again, it's just, you know, and those stories, love them or not, they were homages, they were tributes. I was standing on the shoulders of the Ken Loaches, of the Steven Soderberghs, of the Quentin Tarantinos, of the whatever. And I think it's a responsibility. It's like, what am I putting out there? Like, what can we inspire people to do? And again, I need to do every so often. And when I pick up a book like this, when I pick up a book like your books, I am inspired. I'm like, wow, they swung for the fences. They cleared the fence soundly. And it's so interesting to me. And I think we need more of this in the world. And I think that, I mean, it is the beauty of where comics is now and where we are headed towards this, where it's, well, comics used to be so small and like Hollywood, it was like, well, what you could do in comics, it used to be able to fit a postage stamp. It was like, you needed to go to one of the publishers and you needed like the permission of one of the like 50-year-old white guys in those companies to do your story. And if they didn't give you permission, then your story didn't get made. But now, we can make these things in our basements, and we can put them on Kickstarter, or we can call up a amazing independent bookseller and get them in shops, and we print them down the street if we need to. It is this amazing world where we are all empowered and everything is celebrated. And you know, walk into a comic shop and you see yourself now. You don't see yourself go on Kickstarter. If you don't see yourself there, going to an independent bookseller. I mean, it's really interesting. It's a really wonderful time to be alive. And I don't think there's a lot of strife going on in the world right now. A lot of us got hit in the mouth this week, and we're reeling. And I prefer, rather, you know, I'm still processing and I'm still dealing with it. But there is a lot to love about this world, about this place. And there's a lot of hope everywhere. And I find it in books. I find it in art. I find it in sitting down with amazing artists and having conversations. So that is where my mind goes.
Well, it's a great rant.
No, thank you. And I think it's in some ways all we can do, right? And it's the way we stay sane, and it's the way that we stay connected. Because I think that's probably more than anything, the most important thing now is to find ways to stay connected to mm-hmm. each other's humanity. Like, I'm not necessarily like a Pollyanna person, but I do think that is actually one of the most critical elements of the world as we know it. It always has been. And I think sometimes we lose track of it, but then there are other ways to continue to keep it together. And I think art is just one of those great and amazing ways for, again, people to express themselves, people to connect. And I think, like David, you were saying, is like, to feel like you are heard, or if not heard, at least in some ways understood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was recommending this week to people, and I've watched a few of them myself. I said, you should all watch some World War II movies that were made before they knew how it was going to turn out.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because these are people making movies in a world that's one third under fascist domination, mm-hmm. If not more so. And, you know, Casablanca is the most famous one, obviously. And it's hard to watch Casablanca and realize when that movie comes out, D-Day hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
The Allies are fighting hard in North Africa and in Italy in 1943. You know, it's not, there is no foregone conclusion to Casablanca. You know, and we all got to be Victor Laszlo singing La Marseillaise, man. That's the job. The job is to stand up in a nightclub and sing La Marseillaise. and shout down the Nazis who are singing the Horst Wessel song. You know, that's the, cause you know, you watch, there are a couple movies. I watched Air Force the other night. Air Force is a Howard Hawks movie about the crew of a B-17 bomber. And famously during Pearl Harbor, there was a flight of 9 B-17 bombers that showed up in the middle and went, holy shit, what's going on? And they were unarmed, like they didn't have ammunition on their planes. Mm-hmm. And this movie kind of makes this one bomber crew, they Forrest Gump them for the first 2 weeks of World War II, where they're at Manila during the fall of the Philippines. That like they keep jumping around. Oh, look, we're landing in Wake Island briefly, and these guys are all doomed. And the degree to which that movie is honest, like they're dealing with an audience that's been reading the newspapers. You can't tell them that Pearl Harbor went great. You can't tell them that Wake Island went great. You can't tell them the Philippines went great. You're telling a story about collapse and death and defeat and still managing to make it, but we'll get them. You know, we'll get there. We'll win. It's possible. And seeing that kind of thing, my favorite movie, I think, of that, putting aside Casablanca, which is a masterpiece, there's a movie called Sahara with Bogart also.
Oh, I love that film.
By Zoltan Korda. And that movie is so transparently about the liberal idea of the future. Mm-hmm. Because it's about a tank crew that gets lost in North Africa, and they pick up British soldiers and an Australian soldier and an Italian prisoner of war who's an anti-fascist and a Senegalese black soldier and a free French soldier. And it's all about how the 10 of us are going to beat the fascists because we're all in this together. And even though we're all different from one another and we have nothing in common, what we have in common is that we believe the world should be free and that we should all get along. And it's such a beautifully, like, I don't think it's preachy about that message at all. And it builds up nicely to the like, oh, this tank crew now encompasses every person that is, you know, resisting to fascism right now, including an Italian draftee who hates Mussolini. You know, like, yeah. I mean, and that is so transparent to me of saying, like, look, we're about to beat the Italians in Italy. We should be prepared to embrace them once they've overthrown Mussolini instead of crush them under our boot for having been fascist. And it's a beautiful sentiment. And it's, and again, it's a very dark movie. A lot of the good guys die in it. But you couldn't make a movie in 1943 in which everybody survives a battle.
No, it was too dark.
Everyone was getting telegrams telling them that didn't happen.
Right.
So you had to be honest with people.
You mentioned Hawks, and it's funny. Just not too long ago, we rewatched His Girl Friday. Now, you might think this is totally off kilter, but if you go back and you rewatch His Girl Friday and when the film was made, notice how many references to Hitler there are, how many references there are to communist uprisings, and how it all blends into that room full of journalists who are like the most dreadful human beings on the face of the earth. Like if he plays them for comedy in the original Ben Heck screenplay for the front page, and he adapts it right at that time period. And you get this sense that like, wow, we're really, really screwed.
Yeah.
And it, in a way that like this light comedy in one of our favorite comedies, I think one of the greatest American comedies ever made is His Girl Friday, but how much the underlying tension of what that war was shaping up to be almost prophetic in a way. I had to mention that because as we watched it.
No, it's a great point. And the way in which, you know, you always have to see movies in the context that they were made and what it meant to an audience. One of my favorite lines in Casablanca is when he says to Sam, it's December 1941 in Casablanca. What time is it in New York? The entire audience goes, oh, Pearl Harbor hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
That's why Rick is neutral. That's why this American is not a committed anti-fascist yet. That movie takes place somewhere between December 1st and December 6th, 1941. And at the end, when they're marching off to go to Brazzaville, the whole audience knows they're never making it to Brazzaville because he's going to get the news about Pearl Harbor within the next week. and change, and it's going to change his life completely. You know, he's going to sign up. He's going to, you know, it's the way in which Hollywood was at war with Hitler long before the United States was, and committed to it. And not all of the moguls were behind that idea. Some of them tried to shut it down, but telling people the truth, you know, that's what we're here for. We're here to tell them the truth and tell them what the challenges are and be honest with them about it. And I wrote a comic a few years ago set in 1938, and I was very, very interested in making sure the audience felt 1938. You know, it's hard to, the psychology of like, no, the world is falling to fascism. Like, even though this is a Doc Savage comic and he's a superhero, he's up against forces that are bigger than anyone. And this is what's going on. And you know, there was a line in Air Force just the other night where one of the older characters finds out they're going to, before Pearl Harbor has broken out, he mentions that he has a son in the Air Force in Manila. And you just know the entire audience went, Oh God, this old man doesn't know that within the next 2-3 days, his son's going to be killed in the Japanese invasion. Like, it's tough. It's tough stuff. And removed from that context, it's hard for an audience to feel the same way watching it, not knowing what was going on in everyone's lives. I mean, the degree to which Nixon and Watergate loom over every film in the 70s.
Yes.
You know, and that feeling that the Kennedy assassination, you get 20 years of paranoid political thrillers after that. Because no one believes anything anymore, because someone can shoot the president, apparently, like in a moving limo in Texas, and everybody decides they want to talk about how they feel about that, you know, and that's all valid. I mean, yeah, watching Air Force the other night, I was struck by this movie's made a year and a half after Pearl Harbor. I was like, for an audience, this is like watching one of those 9/11 movies that was made within 5 years of 9/11. This is a traumatic film. Mm-hmm. This isn't just like, oh, it's a World War II movie. It's like, no, this is a movie about the end of the world. This is a movie about people dying. You know, sorry, not to bring us all down, but just to talk about what we infuse our work with that makes it worth doing. And I think you guys are a perfect example of, it always kind of cracks me up when you see someone doing their indie comic on Kickstarter, and it's just like the most generic superhero thing you've ever seen in your life. And you're like, but you're free.
You can do whatever you want.
You could tell any story you want, any way that you want it. You don't need to do this. And look, if you have a great idea for a superhero story, my God, do it. You know, like there are worthwhile stories to do in any genre. You know, I was hired once to direct a low budget exploitation movie. And the only thing I got from the producers was the main character has to be a kickboxer and his girlfriend has to be a stripper.
Wow.
And I'll say my initial response was, ugh. And then a day later I was like, a stripper is a person. A kickboxer is a person. If you can't tell a fucking valid human story about a kickboxer whose girlfriend is a stripper, you have no right to call yourself a writer. Those are two human beings with valid lives. Write a valid story about their lives, or don't. But like that idea of like, oh no, that's gotta suck. No, it really doesn't. The world is full of exploitation movies that prove that no horror movie, no science fiction movie, no action movie has to be bad.
Absolutely. And, you know, just two nights ago, we went to go see Anora. Now, Anora is Sean Baker's film. He did The Florida Project and Tangerine and Red Rocket. It's an exploitation film. Let's be really candid about it. You have someone who's, you know, is working as an exotic dancer and she does sex work on the side, gets involved with this Russian oligarch's son. And then what transpires could be this very simple thing in one way, but it takes on a lot of political weight to it. It takes on,
but not, and I would say, like, not obviously political. Yeah. Something that is a little bit more fundamental about, like, what does it mean to live as an immigrant in America in a way? What does it mean to be, like, a second to third generation American? But it's never articulated.
And it's never preachy in that way. And he won the Palme d'Or this year at Cannes. Like, you think about it, and it's, you know, it's got very graphic sex in it. Yeah. It has exactly the elements. There's no kick boxer, but there's thugs.
There's Russian gangsters. I mean, that's an element, you know. I've read up on it and I saw the trailer and I'm like, it's proof that you could actually make a good movie out of the premise of Pretty Woman.
Right.
Because it's essentially the premise of Pretty Woman. You know, like, rich guy offers sex worker an amount of money to hang out with him for an amount of time, and then hijinks ensue. But what are those hijinks? And, you know, and it's, you know, it's, the story has to take place in the world. There's an essay I love by J.G. Ballard, and I think his tongue is firmly in his cheek, where he says that science fiction is, in fact, not only is it not literature, it is in fact the only valid form of literature. And his premise, which I think is worthwhile, is that society is always in flux. The world is always changing. History is always moving. He said most narratives present a static society in which nothing changes. Science fiction always presents a society that has changed or is in the middle of a change or a metamorphosis. So it is a valid, it is the only valid way of telling stories. I think his tongue is in his cheek writing this essay. It's a forward to it, the edition I have of Crash. Mm-hmm. But I take that to heart in a way, in the sense that, like, literally, I make the first scene in that kickboxing stripper movie. It's about a guy who's in a fighting, an underground fighting club in Hong Kong. Mm. And I was making the movie in 96. I was like, oh, so it's about him having to come to America because the British Empire is about to hand Hong Kong back to the Chinese. Like, so the movie's actually about the sociopolitics of that, but it's very much not about that. It's just, that's the thing. I was like, how can I make an interesting movie about a Hong Kong guy who comes to an America? I was like, well, right now there's a very convincing reason for a criminal in Hong Kong to leave Hong Kong and come to America. And it's about sort of like, again, not to overdress this very low budget movie, but it's like, among other things, it's all just gangs. The communist China is one gang. The triads are another gang. And the American organized crime, the mafia, is just another gang. They're just operating in different spheres. And our hero kind of gets bounced between all of the spheres. But that's just an excuse for a bunch of sex and violence. But it's a real world hook on which to hang all of that. So the movie very firmly takes place in 1997 during the handover. But anyway, we should let you guys go. It has been so lovely to talk to you.
Pleasure.
Do you have any kind of, first off, do you have any kind of schedule for when the next thing is coming out? Do you guys put yourself on any kind of schedule? Is it just, we do it as we do it?
It's a merciless schedule that we impose on ourselves, and it's horrible. And it usually dissolves the entire winter and spring of our lives.
And summer.
And summer,
it also dissolves summer too.
4th of July is usually when we're editing the book. So if you follow us on social media, you'll see very panicked and disturbing things come out. So usually we're trying to get them out before August of every year. That may or may not happen, but we're going to give it our best shot.
And speaking of the internets, where can people find you on the internets?
On Instagram, we are Plastic Grapes, and on Twitter,
Plastic Grapes 99. Someone took Plastic Grapes before we got to it.
Damn them.
Wow. Damn them.
And I'm sure I had one more. And where can people find your pre-existing books? The books that are already finished.
Yeah. So Domino Books actually just restocked all of them recently. Nice. And then outside of that, they are available in some awesome independent bookstores across the country. So Gutter Pop in Buffalo.
Oh yeah. Gutter Pop.
Howling Pages in Chicago.
Bizarro Walk Street in Atlanta. So many shops that have been really.
I think I saw Skylight in Los Angeles, which has got a very nice comics annex.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Great
job. I looked at the page and saw what some of the bookstores were just to see if they were available on here.
Yeah, but we have a Linktree that has all of the, the very fine details and all of these wonderful folks who've been carrying our books.
And all the reviews and all the other stuff too, which is great. And thank you for asking that. That's nice. Please check out our work or at least consider it.
And also thank you for the J.G. Ballard homage. Ballard is a huge, massive influence because he does always think about societies in flux. And that's super important to us. And that is always a big part and a big element of inspiration. So I think when we talk about like lineage, Ballard is certainly a part of our lineage. And then like more recently, a filmmaker like Neil Balufa is also a part of it. Another filmmaker like Apichapong Wirasethakul is too. And but Ballard is a big part of the foundation.
I come to Ballard relatively late in life, so I can't say he's an influence. I mean, he's an influence on me now, but he wasn't an influence on me. But William Burroughs and Philip K. Dick, who are very Ballardian figures in what they wrote, were big influences on me. And I love the Cronenberg film of Crash, which I think does something. I can only think of one other film, and that's Fellini's Satyricon, which what's science fictional about it is literally the psychology of the characters.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That is hard to do. That is almost impossible to... I always think you should approach period things like science fiction, because it's like these people think differently than you do. They really do. Like they experience life in such a different way that they might as well be on another... The past is another planet. And Satyricon absolutely feels like a science fiction movie. And in Crash, the characters say things and you're like, why would anyone ever think that? Like, how does your mind work that's your response to this situation? But that's the world we're in. And I get it. And I think anyone who's ever been in a car crash understands that on a very deep level, which most Westerners have. Ryland, where can the kids find you on the interwebs and so forth?
I am at Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. It's R-I-L-E-N-D-G-R-A-N-T if you were just listening. I know most of you are. I have to spell it because it's not a real name. I just drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it, so now I have to spell it for you. Find a streamer, check out State of Consciousness. Better yet, check out Haunted Heart. It's a much better movie. Proud of that one. Go see it. Go leave a review online because it has just not been reviewed.
And it's on Netflix, right? Is that right? Or is it on Prime?
Haunted Heart is still a VOD thing, and I will come back to you with the traditional streamer announcements. It'll get covered more as it hits the traditional streamers. But man, we are in a weird time right now. It is a great film that was dumped into a crack between eras. And so go find it. Go, if you like it, go tell people that you like it and tell them that they watch it. And then in my comics, if you go to, I have a backer kit up right now. Is it thebreach.backerkit.com is where you're going to find that stuff. So go check that out. You'll find The Breach, you'll find The Jump, you'll find Aberrant Banjax, all that stuff. Stuff on Amazon, stuff in fine comic shops, you'll find me. Go do it. I'm battling right now because I'm sick. I apologize.
Sorry.
Bring us home, Abalone, before
I can be easily found on a website, which is davidavalonefreelance.com, that links to all of the things. I have recently, a year ago, I set up shop at Blue Sky. And I got to tell you, that is overtaken Twitter as the most useful place for a social media presence. And I am recommending it to everyone. I will tell the very brief story that I posted something on Twitter where I had at the time over 12,000 followers, posted exactly the same thing on Blue Sky where I had at the time about 2,500 followers. It got 500 likes on Blue Sky and 30 on Twitter.
Wow.
With 10,000 more followers. So I think Elon has finally tweaked the algorithm and achieved absolute uselessness as a promotional tool. The engagement on Blue Sky is out of this world right now, and it has a great comics community. So I am recommending that to everyone as the place to go. Your local comic shop probably has Drawing Blood 1 through 6. Please pick it up. I have a bunch of Elvira trade paperbacks out there from my Elvira comics. And Two-Fisted Fairy Tales, speaking of the Haunted Tank and DC War Comics from the 70s, Two-Fisted Fairy Tales will be coming from Dynamite next year. I've just signed a contract on that, and you should keep an eye out for it because that will be probably my favorite thing I've ever done. Thank you so much for joining us and for listening, and we will see you all on the next episode.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more Madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.